Welcome to the Your Data Driven Podcast. If you like this podcast, be sure to visit our website at yourdatadriven.com for more useful help and advice on setting up your race car, mastering data analysis, and driving faster. Welcome to episode 18. In this episode, I'm absolutely delighted to welcome Scott Gardner. Scott is a sports scientist by training, but has worked as a head coach in a number of different sports, particularly in cycling. Scott has been part of the inner circle for some huge sporting success over the last few years in Australia and in the UK as part of Team GB. In this episode, we explore what it's like to perform at the very highest level. Scott's really into motorsports as well, and we learn what you can take away from that to bring back into your own racing. It's a really fascinating episode, and I hope you get so much from it. So as always, grab a pen, grab your coffee, sit back, and enjoy what Scott has to say. So welcome, Scott.
Thanks, Amir. How are you?
I'm very well. I'm very well. Thank you so much in advance for taking the time to speak to us today. Slightly different person to our normal guest, but I think everyone will find this absolutely fascinating to listen to what you have to say. I'm really excited to hear about some of your experience in Olympic sports and how that can translate into our world of club motorsport, and just listen to how you approach the different elements of racing. We both call it racing, but there's ever so slightly different emphasis in the world of cycling as there is in motorsports. But ultimately, we're both trying to get from A to B as quickly as possible. We've got a piece of equipment that has a big impact, cycling less of an impact than in racing. But we also got the psychological side and how we prepare and train for each of our events. And it would just be really interesting to hear a little bit about your backstory, so that for the benefit of people who don't know who you are, and then we can try to maybe explore some of those topics in a way that maybe people get one or two takeaways that they can then apply back into their own racing. How does that sound?
Sounds great. I appreciate it. Thanks very much for having me all the way here at the moment from Tasmania on the bottom of the Atlantic. Fantastic. Now, I hope we can find some synergies, because ultimately, I think, you know, the tactical, technical, physiological and psychological elements all massively apply, certainly for us in Olympic sport, whereas the physiological is probably just your engine horsepower in a car racing analogy. So you have to understand its range of torque to revs and where it produces its horsepower, and tactical, technical, physiological, psychological components all apply massively. So,
well, so that's an interesting point you make. From the little bit of work that you and I have done together, it's not only about those basic kind of engine analogies, but it's like when you deploy the different, you know, peaks of energy that you have, particularly in a sort of track cycling environment. And it's a little bit of the analogy might be when you would deploy some kind of electrical assistance KERS type thing in your racing car, that kind of thing, or when to push and when to hold back. Whilst driving a car in a circle isn't as physically demanding aerobically anyway, mentally it's very challenging. And I think that would be an interesting one, interesting little area to explore at some point later.
Yeah, for sure.
So tell us about you.
So my background is sports science. Started here in Australia. Did my PhD working with the Australian cycling team in Athens, which was a very successful Olympic campaign for the Australian team on the track. And that grabbed some attention. I think we won 6 gold medals or something. That's not good. I can't quite remember exactly how many, but it was hugely exciting. And I was mainly working with the sprint cyclist and had double Olympic champion Ryan Bailey. Anna Mears, who some Brits might know from another rivalry, which I was very close to as well from both sides at certain points. And it grabbed some attention. And then that was really where Dave Brailsford in the UK said, no, the UK is going to dominate and we're going to go and get all the best people on the planet and put them into the Velodrome setup in Manchester. And so in 2000 and 2005, I moved over to the UK, started working with the British cycling team, went through that Beijing cycle, ended up working with some other sports in the UK post that even more successful Olympics than record-breaking, groundbreaking. So Chris Hoy with Victoria Pendleton and Jason Kenny, who most people, you know, who is actually one of Britain's most decorated Olympians, certainly doesn't get the publicity that Chris Hoy gets.
So Chris Hoy's a motor racing guy, so we're big fans of Chris.
I went to Bolivia with Chris at one point. We went and did this amazing thing where he went to break the standing kilometer world record. And this was a documentary only broadcast on BBC Scotland. So other people in the UK probably haven't seen this unless you're Scottish. Jill Douglas did the voiceover and ended up in Florida with us at one point as we did it. And he went for the kilometre world record. We went to Bolivia to 3,200 metres above sea level because of the air density, because it's the right place to be if you want to go for a kilometre on a bike really fast. Just happened that the track we were using, we spackerfilled all the cracks and holes on the old concrete track. Now they have a 250 indoor amazing thing up there in La Paz, but at this stage it wasn't quite like that. Yeah, he did that anyway. He missed by 0.005 of a second.
Oh, come on.
Over two attempts. And it was probably the reason, or certainly for me, one of the reasons he had such a successful Olympics in 2008. It really trained and supported us in understanding attention to detail. We did two debriefs after that and came up with about 9 places he could have found that 0.005 of a second quite easily. And I'm still not over it. I'm really still not over it. He got over it much quicker than I did, which is the sense of champion athlete, being able to move on and focus on the next thing. I certainly couldn't on some of the decisions, but we all learned so much from it. And the party at the end was fantastic.
Great.
Highlight of my life. Anyway, how did we get onto that one?
Chris Hoy, he's a racing driver.
Yeah, so I've worked with Chris Hoy, who is a racing driver, who has done Le Mans, who has done lots of things in racing, and worked also following that. I did a year with British Swimming, was head coach for British Canoeing for a couple of years, and then found myself back in Olympic sport in all sorts of areas, consulting while starting up a leadership coaching company, Track Record Coaching, out of the UK, which is in London, which uses some of those experiences and this whole concept of performance planning in Olympic sport to support leadership teams in business. And it's been really successful. And so certain with Olympics, I started that up with David Carey, former swimmer, another Scottish, something I don't know what that means.
Just maybe there's a theme there.
but also with Catherine Moore, who was a head physio for us at British Canoeing for a long time and has worked with Ed McKeever, worked with Liam Heath, worked with Olympic champions and Tim Brabants. Some people might have heard of Dr. Tim Brabants. So work with a series of Olympic champions over years and their coaches. And Hannah McLeod also does quite a lot of work with us. So she was a member of the GB hockey team that famously won gold in 2016. And a fantastic example of performance planning and understanding your strengths and knowing how you're going to win. And, quite close with the coach, Danny Carey, who was really part of the mastermind of that.
So but just can we explore that a little bit? Because as I just think it's fascinating and again it's humbling to have you on the show really to talk to us, but how can we take some of that performance? What do you really mean by that? And how can someone who is like an amateur in their sport take some of that? Because so cycling, which is your primary, it's what I think of you in terms of for cycling. It has a lot of similarities with motorsport. There's a strong professional level of competition. There's the amateurs, and then there's the very serious amateurs as well. And so how can we learn from that performance planning element that would apply equally to a club-level cyclist as it would do to a club-level racing driver?
Yeah, it's interesting. You say cycling is definitely my specialist area, but I've been lucky enough to not work in cycling for a while and work through understanding the process that we go through in order to performance plan. And the experiences to work within swimming, so you get in your own conventional wisdom when you work within one area, yeah. and then be able to then work in another sport and then another sport to be a head coach is all about starting to help people get this sense of what's a win. And a win's not winning a gold medal. A win, because that's a movable target. You don't know how anyone else is going to turn up. You don't know all those other constraints. So it is, what do you need to do and what would you be satisfied in having, win, lose or draw, to be able to. So it's getting this end in mind and really having these strong conversations about what is that. So in a cycling sense, I might want to be able to ride 9.6 seconds for a flying 200 with a tactical ability to race from the front and the back, and let's have a chat through that. In that hockey example I spoke about there before, one part of that was about penalties. And it was a really interesting thing. They won the Olympics on penalties. I actually remember hearing on Five Live, I was driving along the motorway and I heard when the girls had come back, two of them were on Five Live, and they also had Sam Allardyce, who it was about that period where the England football team was in a bit of chaos, and Big Sam had just been, hadn't been sacked yet, I think he was in, and he was interviewed and he was saying, you can't make players practice penalties. And it was like, whoa, it's like, this is football. Is this true? Exactly. Then you had these women were then asked straight after they'd won Olympic gold medal, what do you think of what Sam said? And then they're like, we can't comment on what he said, but what we can tell you about is what we did. And we practiced penalties. We studied every goalkeeper we were going to come up against. We knew that 98% of the time, or however, whatever the percentage was, for each goalkeeper, they went to their strengths. We practiced that. We mimicked that. We trained all those elements of that. And so then when it came to having this penalty shootout, it was like all I was doing was I was with my group of girls back at Bisham Abbey. I wasn't at the Olympic Games in that moment. I'd practiced it, rehearsed it under pressure to be able to walk out. I knew the goalkeeper back to front because we'd one, practiced it and or played against them and or studied and watched footage and everything. So I had a fair sense of where to hit the ball, and I went out and I hit it as though it was another day of training, because I understood what that was going to be. And then you hear this whole thing of prayers and all this being, all this stuff that you hear from football, and it's no. And then they're like, and then the girls were amazing. They were like, and it came down to a whole team approach. It wasn't just us out on the pitch. It was the whole squad that had done that. And there was a massive thank you to the three other goalkeepers who didn't get to play on the day, but had been a massive part in creating that Olympic gold medal. So it's a long way, just short of, or long story to tell you about getting in that moment, understanding what are the elements that are going to help you to win, and just becoming really expert in those and not getting carried away and worried in all these other areas.
So there's actually two things that I've picked up on there is defining what success looks like for yourself at the moment. And that's a really big deal, because I see a lot of glum faces around a motorsports paddock, because there's 30 odd cars go out for a race or whatever, hopefully that many, 30 or 40 cars, whatever. But there can only be one winner and there can only be three people on the podium. So everyone else is emotionally lost. And I think there's a lot of benefit in terms of being able to be realistic. And that's the thing, people use the wrong term. I think it's quite a negative term, realistic, personally. Just to set some goals. And then it's about the other bit is trying to play to your strengths, or at least work out part of the puzzle that you feel is going to be, have a big impact on the performance, and then just working on that. It sounds like you put a lot of effort into penalties, a lot. It's not just, we finished the training session.
I wasn't a part of it, but certainly that team spent a lot of time over the years knowing that was a huge part and a potential part of winning. And ultimately, you can only be satisfied if you performance plan well, which is end in mind, planning as a verb in terms of a process of, that you continuously go through in order to understand what it is that takes you, that's going to help you to win. If you are, if you achieve everything you set out to achieve in terms of I can ride this fast, I've improved my aero by this much, my horsepower has gone up by this much, I've understood the things that might be thrown at me, and you go out and you don't win, but you've got all the things that you thought you might need, you can't be not satisfied. Yeah. Because that is a win. And it's about finding this process, controlling the controllables, process focus in terms of those are your wins. I see it too. I watch a lot of motorsport. I watch a lot of Formula One. But I also see it in cycling with teams that haven't got it quite right, where the people put these false expectations that winning is not the only win. This is everything we do in life. And we have to find the small things. What would be a win for you today, Samir?
Talking to you is a win.
Hey, we know we're not going to win the race today. So what would be a win? What are you going to be satisfied with? Make sure it's ambitious. Make sure it's high expectation. Make sure that the support level is matched in terms of what's required to be able to achieve it. It's got to be audacious. It's got to be ambitious. But it certainly doesn't have to be winning in terms of crossing the line first, because it's what would you be satisfied with that is really stretch.
You pull up a really good point there, and I've circled it here. It's about support. And one of the things that motorsport has traditionally, and I would say still lacks, is support from a coaching perspective.
Yeah.
And I'd be really interested for you to share with us your definition of coaching and how that plays into this. Because just to put that into some context, in racing, people call themselves a coach, but really they're an instructor trying to help you drive better. So they're trying to help you work out how to go around the track faster than you can go. And their credentials are that they can do it quicker than you, and so they can show you, and then they sit next to you and then shout at you or talk to you in different ways to try and get you to match what they do. But in sport, it's a slightly different relationship, I would say. And I do understand there are different levels depending on where you're at. So if you're starting out, you need some instruction. But equally, I think that the concept of having a support team, it's still particularly novel. I would say definitely at an amateur level. So how do you understand that?
I'm going to hit this from two parts. Before I get to the coaching bit, I'm going to just – there's a fantastic little piece of research that actually happened in – I think it was county cricket clubs or something a long time ago. And it was run – Simon Timpson was a big part of it, who was head of UK sport for a while. He's I think he's in like Manchester City. He and a lot of people were part of a big piece of research, which was all around transformational leadership and understanding how to create performance and lead it through leadership. And it is this whole thing. I see this poorly done usually in motorsport, I think, but I also see it poorly done in all other sports. But because motorsport and, you know, I watch the Formula One channel a lot, I make a lot of thoughts around it. But higher performance or extraordinary performance outcomes come from, like a three-legged chair, when there are three things in place. First is high expectation, our performance expectation. It's not outcome focused, but it is about all these things that we were talking about there before. It is what are the things that it's going to take and in order to be successful, matched with support and high levels of support that we just spoke about there. And that is not, oh, poor, you're having a bad day today. That is, in order to achieve what we set out to achieve and our expectation is here, what do you need in order to be able to achieve that? I'm here to support you, to help you, to whatever it is that you need, but you have to identify those things that you're going to need, and creating some form of growth mindset around that into, from leadership, values-based role modeling. So we value this support, these expectations, and some other things. And if we can match all those. Now, the research showed if you don't have support, you don't have role modeling, and you have high expectation, you are worse off than having nothing or having low levels of everything. And it's the same with too much support. If you've just got a massive amount of support with no expectation and no role modeling, then you need all three matched. And when teams get that, we see it in sports teams, we see it in probably in motorsport teams too, when you get the high levels of all right, then that is when the magic happens.
What do you mean by role modeling?
So role modeling is from leaders and leadership. Change and performance is done by you. It's not done by... So people stand there, and I've been a part. I did some coaching at one point with the McLaren race team a few years back when they were in the doldrums a little bit. That I know that I knew their physiotherapist.
Just all the Formula One teams, all the F1 drivers, they all listen to the show. Yeah, just so you know.
Two of them will remember us because we had them in a... We went to St. George's Park to the FA, and we were in a locker room downstairs. And
that's a facility and a half. Oh my god!
So brilliant. This was the race team. They'd been practicing chain pit stops and other things, and they were going through a bunch of work in terms of how to be better at what they did. Now, of course, they were really focused on did we have a good car this year, rather than are we ready to win. Even if we don't have a good car, are we training and being prepared to win in terms of if we don't, then we won't necessarily or whatever. So it is change and performance is done by everyone. So people then go, oh, it was management's fault. It's not always management's fault. Or there. So, yes, role modeling from leadership is the key, is important. But also it is a matter of understanding that if you want things to be better, you own and control you're part of that. And if something needs to be said, then something needs to be said, or it is a part. It is a choice to be somewhere, or it's a tough choice to leave a particular place like that. But it is a choice to be there. And if people want, and in true successful teams, everyone owns their role and owns their part of the performance. And it's values-based. There are things that you value in that culture. And the reason we get a clash often is clash of values, whether it's a communication style or whether it's a whatever it is values based. So decide on the values, be clear on the values. For us, the best teams in the world also have a common purpose. They're not, and purposes are different to a win. So often people go, our purpose is to win races. It's not. What will winning get you? What's your passion? Who do you serve? Questions like that allow you to find purpose and meaning in the role, in the job, in the wherever you're trying to go, and you need to have a semi.
This is really fascinating because I've just taken on a driver. I'm doing a bit of coaching too, and he's really successful. This guy, he's a winner.
Yep.
So it was like, all right, what is it that you want? what is it that's going to take you to that next step? What is it that you're almost worried about in the sense of why would you need this extra help or support? And therefore, he found it really difficult to articulate.
It is because we get into sport because we want to win. Like we're talking about winning here, but what does winning get you? When winning's finished, when you're done, what's the next phase, and can you follow your same path and give back or leave a legacy or whatever it is that's there? So winning is not purpose. Winning is a goal. Winning is just something along the way that helps you fulfill part of your purpose. And you're a long time retired when you finish a lot of these things, particularly in Olympic sport. And so how are you going to continue to follow that purpose? So the best teams have purpose, they have common values, they then align and have clarity in what they're trying to achieve. So everyone's trying to achieve the same thing, not different things, which you'd be amazed how often people are trying to achieve different things, even though we think you're trying to achieve the same thing. And then it's all about planning and putting those things at the end and working through a process of what's important, prioritization, and dealing with that. So then you can check in on, hey, you're a little bit off track. What do you need? we've agreed where we're going, and it's either not good enough, and that becomes a performance conversation, not a difficult one, because we've all agreed and we know where we're going. And some people might say, look, oh, I just need this, I've got this issue. And other people might go, I'm just not in this anymore. I don't agree with the purpose. I'm really not up for that win. And sorry, guys, I'm out. And so often when in track record, we've worked with leadership teams. In the first place, we have those conversations over a period of time. And one or two people actually just opt out themselves because they got a different dream. They got a different ambition, and or they don't have enough energy for that challenge because we've set pretty audacious and high expectations. Got into that expectation support and role modeling part, but it is that constant conversation about what it's going to take to win. Now, going to your actual question, which was around coaching and what is coaching, and because that definition is wide open. And like you say, so many people come, you say, like in motorsport, like an instructor.
Exactly. I've just described myself as coach. I said, oh, I'm doing a bit of coaching, aren't I? It's like, but I'm not a coach. Like, I'm an engineer. Yeah. But it's just and the coaching work that I had done.
I'm a sports scientist, and I was head coach for British Canoeing.
Yeah.
And I probably, if I'm actually, but I've also started up a leadership coaching business. So I now call myself a coach. But so what is it? And in Olympic sport, if you can imagine sort of two axes, you've got on the x-axis, you've got technical knowledge. So we've got low technical knowledge and we've got high technical knowledge, okay? And then on the y-axis, if we say we've got directive behavior, so we've got low directive behavior, which is I ask really open questions. How are you today, Samir? And it's up to you to answer that in whatever way. Up to really directive behavior, which is on that turn, make sure you take the apex at that point, if that makes sense, or something.
Really makes sense, yeah.
That might be something like you might say. So traditionally in sport, we get into what coaching has been is really high directive behavior and really high technical knowledge. So I can say to you on that apex, pick that point on that bit and go for it. So at certain points, and in football it might be go and stand on the wing and make sure you're at exactly this point, watch for his right foot, and you know, he'll try and step you at this point because that person knows and can help you. So what that has done though, what that does is every time you do that, you just try and do the same thing. But if a different constraint is thrown at you at our point, I've had to go wide to make an overtake, but yet I'm still trying to get that point on that apex. It doesn't always allow us to be in, create a learning environment. The definition in sport is, though, directive behavior and high technical knowledge. In business coaching, usually it is low technical knowledge,
yeah,
and low directive behavior. So I can go into business and I can coach a leadership team, and I've coached FTSE 30 leadership teams and CEOs with no knowledge of business, with no understanding of their day-to-day, and I'm not even pretending to be it in to be or understand what they do, but by asking open questions, what are you trying to achieve? How are you trying to get there? What are the things that are going to get in your way? What would be the mitigating circumstances for us to be able to deal with the causes or consequences of that issue, et cetera? And they're up to them. You're coaching someone to understand from their own environment and ask them questions that help them, particularly open questions that help them to create their plan. And by knowing a bit of process associated, you can work through it.
I think your point on the learning environment is really good because, again, even in my work in sports teams, they don't always consider that they have a learning environment. This is at an Olympic level. So one of the things I say, because I'm an engineer and a data guy, and so people expect if they have a low technical knowledge, they expect the data people, whatever, the geeks, to be able to give them a definite answer on some simple questions. And that's really reasonable expectations. And the problem that data people and the geeks have is there isn't a way of robustly giving a simple, straightforward answer to those simple, straightforward questions. And I think that's sometimes where the confusion comes in between those kind of groups of people. And therefore, it's a case of how do you deal with that? Because you might say, well, if you make this change to the car, I expect you're going to go faster. And then you drive around and you go slower. And then then we've got a problem, potentially, if we haven't created a learning environment. So if we haven't created the expectation that this could go either way, it's a hypothesis, not a given. We've done everything we can. And it's based on solid reasoning and physics and experience and everything we've said, but it may still may not work, but we will still learn from it either way. That doesn't matter if we go slower.
Yeah.
Because we won't do it again, and we'll understand why we went slower by doing this experiment and creating motor racing as a kind of science experiment or going racing as a science experiment. But people don't like the word science, so maybe our learning environment is more a softer approach. But I think the concept is the same, both in terms of functional changes to the car, but also experimenting with your driving and improving. And I think it's a much more positive environment for me.
Totally. Go back to the experience. Chris Hoy, he missed the world record in Bolivia by 0.005 of a second. What would you do differently next time, now that we've had a conversation that we've found 9 different elements that might have been in skin suit, in wheel, in helmet, in line on the track, on day that we got there, in all sorts of things? And so therefore it doesn't end at, oh, these are all the things that might have happened. The end is the next part of the conversation, which is, now that you've got that, okay, what are your options, and what, and then specifically, what are you going to do differently next time? And what question do you want me to ask you next time I see you about what you tried and how that went? And it's a continuous loop of, what are you trying to achieve? Why is it important? What are our options? And what are we going to do?
I think there's an ownership piece around that, actually.
Well, that's the coaching part of it. So I can ask you, what are you trying to achieve? I can ask you, why is that important? It's important to me for this reason, but why is it important to you? You start to own it. You then go into, so what options have you got? And usually, rather than me just tell you straight away in that sort of coaching environment, I'm not going to tell you straight away, even though I probably know the answer. I know to hit the apex at that point. But unless I've actually asked you, what would you do? Where do you think you need to be? What would happen if you had a car that you was on the inside of you? How would you handle that? And get to the point of all the options that you've got. And then what are you going to, and they'll then ask you in that sort of coaching sense. They then start to go, what would you do? And I'll go, well, what I would do if I was you would be do this. How does that sound to you? And then you also get into this, then they're trusting, and you've got this co-creation and ownership that's on both parts to then get into what you're going to do.
The trust bit is really important, because and the respect, because depending on how you set the relationships up, the there's always a question mark. So some of the stuff that engineers or whatever data people can do with, it's like voodoo. It's like crazy stuff. It's not easy to understand. And and honestly, I'm someone who's meant to know what they're doing, and I still don't get it like half the time. So if people are relying on that instructional kind of relationship, I think that possibly that's maybe where it breaks down. They want to be told what to do, so they don't have to think. But really, what you're saying is it's much better if you take ownership of it. It's a more mature way of going about your sport, and therefore that will give you a much higher chance of effectively being successful and enjoying it more. Is that kind of...
Yeah, at least they've... If they want you to tell you, at least you've given them the option to say, tell me. So if it's I have worked with Olympic athletes who really don't want to think, but then you work with someone like Sir Chris, who is all about thinking, and he wants to know his options, and he wants to be able to make his own decisions. And that's a different, more, you know, I'd say it's a mature type relationship, but it doesn't mean it's not high challenge.
I've got another guy that I'm working with, and he's that. He's really analytical to the point where I think it can make him claustrophobic when he's racing. And it's, you just so with that guy, you've got to take him back and just say, look, stop. Like, we worked it out. 1, 2, 3, just do that. Everything else is fine.
I work with a coach who is similar, like people who love those details. And your role in that sense is to, well, you're getting caught up in the details here way too much, and to be able, but they have to, that trust has to be given to you, and you have to earn that. And that's the way the conversation, by running through an open conversation more than just jumping straight in. Too many people and too many young sports scientists in Olympic sport go straight in, and they're working with Olympic coaches or whoever, and they can see something that should be different, should be better, and they know it. So then they just jump in and give advice. And I've had moments of that. I was years back, actually, where I thought I was in Switzerland. I was in a velodrome, Olympic Cycling Centre. I was in my first big Australian trip. I'd been doing really well. I was in a meeting, which was in the workshop out the back, and it was a selection decision going into a Commonwealth Games, I think it was, back in Manchester, and in 2002 or something, I think it was. And I offered advice. Maybe when I wasn't quite asked, told me to, who the f*** asked you? And then it was like, oh, I hadn't been given permission and I wasn't in on that. And we see that everywhere where advice is offered, but it's actually not helpful.
But how do you deal with a situation where you're put on the spot and there isn't really a good answer to give, or you haven't got one?
Give me an example.
So I'm making this up, but basically, what tire pressure should we run? We can run anything between 20 and 30 psi. What should we run? And we can have each tire different. What is it that we should do? We're about to go out and we want to have a choice. We need a decision. Now, I've actually got an answer for that, but it's, you're on the spot and there isn't really a right answer.
Yeah,
it's, you could do this or you could do that or whatever. It would have a different impact on what the experience is like driving in a circle. So how do you tackle that?
Yeah, there's not really much useful information that can be given at the ninth hour about to go out. And it does happen though, right? It really does happen. Often it can be as confusing and conflicting and not really help. I think ultimately you have to set that moment up for what you really need to be able to make those decisions better and help the driver or the whoever it is to understand that decision is not to be made at the ninth hour or about to go out. But that's not useful at that moment. So you would use that to set up, look, we've got these options in these conditions. You know, ultimately, what are you trying to achieve? And for me, it becomes a lot of their choice.
Yeah, it comes back round to what you're saying. And
it's, you still have to empower and help them to own that decision. You're there to help give data, information, context for them to be able to make that decision better. But too often, they're like, I've employed you. Here you are. Make sure. Give me that number. And it for me is set up before that. And if you're at that point where it's, I'm just in for today to be here, it's a really tricky one. And that's why you get so much fence sitting at that moment, I suppose.
Or at least that's where the caveat book comes out, and the wind's different or the track's a different temperature, or I don't know. There's a whole long shopping list of things that the driver can do that would take me get you out of jail on that.
If you've performance planned well and done your work coming in, that doesn't happen. So when you're in the best team, at least you would know that you don't know, or you would know and you would accept that you don't know, or you would know that you've planned for that situation and that scenario. So there are key important things. There's like a critical pathway to achieving anything you want to achieve. And on that critical pathway, those are the things that you just have to get right. And if you don't get them right, you will never achieve what you set out to achieve. In business coaching now, we call them critical elements, but they are the big chunks, the big buckets in order to achieve anything you've got. So for us to win an Olympic gold medal in cycling, we know based on an athlete that we need to get more horsepower. And we need to understand the constraints on that horsepower and that engine. We know that in sprinting, our optimal rev range is 120 RPM. That's where our max power is. We have to get, in order to do that, we have to deal with the gear and other stuff.
That's really quick.
But when you're sprinting, though, it's not. If you're riding along on the road, if you actually sprint through the full range, you as fast as you can probably spin your legs on a bike is around about 240 for a standard human being. At 240, there's no torque on the pedals. And at zero, there's a shitload. Sorry, I shouldn't be swearing on a podcast, should I? I'm not sure. But at zero, and your optimal, given a torque cadence relationship in sprint cycling anyway, is basically linear between those two points. So you end up with a, for power cadence, you end up with a parabolic relationship, and the apex is about 120 RPM. So understand your engine. Also understand your aero and your elements of it. This is where the whole marginal gains concept that people talk about in business and in other areas really truly came from. It is, if I want to improve my aero by how much in cycling sense, then we'll look at all these little areas and we can improve this by 1%, that by 0.5%, this by 3%, and we'll end up with hopefully a 10% gain in aero. There's also that whole psychological element, being able to perform under pressure on race day and understand the things that have come at me. Those sort of examples. So they're your big buckets. In order for the engine to respond, this is where you see hear all the stuff about sleep and nutrition and everything. So it's another big bucket, is in that whole recovery and that zone. And that's where you see those marginal gains in underneath all those. The marginal gains come in the big buckets, and they're the critical elements that you have to get right, where you're going to find your percentage points. And then, so anything else, once you've agreed on those bits, is noise. It's just, and too many people come along with parts of noise, and now we've got this new fancy machine that's going to do this for you, and it's just outside. We know what we need to focus on, and the best teams, the stuff Sky were doing and Tim Kerrison's doing with Sky into Ineos and whatever, they keep it simple, mate. They are focused on aero and got the boffins doing bits. They are focused, but they keep day-to-day really simple. They don't get carried away with too much of the hard stuff that doesn't fit in your critical buckets.
That's brilliant. It's really interesting to take some of this stuff, because, like I said, we've talked all about the human being part, and in motorsport, we spend a lot of time talking about the car part, I would say. How do you marry the two? Because cycling's quite technical as a sport as well. And what's your, and people obsess about their bikes. Particularly, I would say my limited experience of amateur cycling, they really, you know, enjoy that as well, as much as they do with the car racing. So what's your perspective on equipment and using that and developing maybe what you have? Is there a process that you go through with that, or does that just all fit in with this learning model? What does it take?
It fits in. It fits 100% in, and all of that stuff is in a critical element. And if it's going to take this much to win, and we need to find 10% to improve, then we're going to find. Let's say we can find 2% from our physiology. Let's say we know we can find 3% from our just being prepared to prepare and win under pressure and practice under pressure and deal with that consequences of bad decisions and improving that. And then the other bit is in a bucket of, for us in cycling, in the technological and aero part. But it's not only that, it's in efficiency and it's in inertia. So if we can understand those three areas better, then again, we can then maybe say we will find 4% there, and we can target set in each of those areas. We know where we need to be, and then we'll find our 10. I think I might have just added up to 9. But anyway, but you certainly see what I mean. The big gains that we're making at the moment, bringing the athlete in, the ownership that we spoke about earlier, having the athlete as a part of that performance plan, and they own their own aero. Funny enough, hey? It's wow. Their performance. They own it. We are there to coach them to understand it, because we know it and get it better. And we know, I remember prior to 2012, I said to a coach, we had a model, we had a spreadsheet that I could predict a flying 200 meter time and with Victoria Pendleton back then. And I put it in an envelope and I said, here you go, here's the time that she will ride. And I got her Olympic record within 2/1000th of a second. Now, we did that work with Fraser Nash and Alistair Wiley and a group of guys there. But I'd also published and done stuff in 2003 with Professor Jim Martin when I was doing my PhD with the Australian cycling team where we created models. So I'd been au fait with it all the way up. But we put it in an envelope. But I say to a coach, this is what it's going to be. Here's the model. And they're like, you can't do that. It's mythical. It's like black box type stuff, even back in 2012, whereas now they do understand that we do understand the physics. We can then bring that together in a spreadsheet once we understand the engine better, which is what we've done now. You and I talked a while back on creating gear models for cyclists. Well, we can do that now, and we can integrate the physiological or the engine and the aero. And out the other side, we can then pick the optimal gear with fatigue is a big part for us, that you don't get your horsepower drops and with that, your optimal cadence drops as well. So, you know, that we talked about your optimal cadence at 120 when you're fatigue free. Well, as you fatigue, that optimal cadence drops. So you have to have an understanding of that. And then, but then you can create models that allow you to do all sorts of stuff.
And this is the thing. So the motorsports community have long created models. At an amateur level, though, I'm not sure that people are super comfortable with that. So basically what you're saying is that you've now transitioned through that in the sense of you're making sure the athlete is taking ownership of that part of things as well, and they understand it.
It is part of the creation of it.
Yeah.
And therefore it's not just...
do that. Yeah.
Do that. No, it's not just do that. They're a big part of, we sit down at the beginning of the cycle and we talk about what do you want to achieve and how do you want to go about it and here's what we bring. And they're just the big, they're as important. Everyone's got a role. The athlete's role is to go out and steer the bike or ride from A to A. They don't even ride from A to B. In track cycling, they don't even ride from A to B. They ride to the same place.
Everyone listening to this show is able to do is drive a racing line, and you watch some of the cyclists with all due respect, and it's just what
you're standing on a mountain stage on the Tour de France and seeing a racing line. It's like, oh, you'll see some. So it's probably because they're not doing this well. They're not actually practicing and learning. So that you know, a big part of winning the Tour de France is about descending down mountains. But the conventional wisdom is it's how fast you go up.
Yeah.
So I've seen footage a couple of years back at a Tour de France, and there was a speed trap going downhill on the time trial that Chris Froome won a couple of tours back. And, of course, it was an uphill to get there. So a lot of these cyclists change their bike to be on a bike that's half a kilo lighter just to be able to go up this hill just because maybe they're positioned slightly better on the time trial bike. Some of them change that bike, whether it's right or wrong, but a big decision. But then they stayed on that bike for the descent because it was only a short descent. And in one of the speed traps, Chris Froome's going through there at 78K an hour or something, and the other guy on the regular bike's going through at 55. And so he's climbed the hill faster, but thinking they're doing the right thing because they haven't looked at the big picture and they haven't planned it out.
And the analogy there is, in a racing environment, is the braking zones, because it's probably it's the highest skill element, the braking and that initial turning in. It's the highest skill. It's the biggest thing you do as a driver in terms of your skill bit is that. But you only brake typically for a very small proportion of the total lap. All the focus is on that bit because it's high skill and everything like that. And, you know, I want to brake a bit later and get turned into the corner, and how do I trail brake and how do I get the car rotated and all this sort of stuff. But really the focus or the most time to be gained is from the exit, getting a better exit onto the straight. And if you can get one mile an hour more, you carry that all the way down the straight compared to breaking that like 10th later on the way in, and then it's a risk ratio. So if you can do it, like if you're a professional driver, then you can do it. But at a club level, we're so prone to mistakes anyway. We want to like minimize the amount of mistakes for the highest lap time return.
Yeah. No, it's fascinating, isn't it? And you're reminding me of a story, and a lot of your listeners will probably be aware of an athlete, Becky Adlington, who was Olympic gold medalist back in, what was it, 2008. And I worked with British Swimming for a while, and it's the same thing. Focus is on, in that sport, is on swimming, the swimming part, whereas there's this massive part of it, which is the turns. There's this thing that we've got to do, which is breathing. And so every stroke when an athlete breathes, they tend to lose about a tenth of a second. And a lot of athletes, in this particular athlete, I had a conversation with this athlete's coach, and it was every time she goes into that turn, she is over-breathing and she's losing a tenth of a second. Now, she's got 16 turns in her race, and even if she can improve her turn breathing into turns and she doesn't lose that tenth of a second, then we've got 1.6 seconds to gain, which would smash a world record. And so here's where the gain is. And it can be done because you see that athlete, and that athlete in your race is not doing it. So it's not as though it's not impossible, but the focus is all on swimming faster and doing miles and miles of swimming rather than dealing with this 5 meters in, 10 meters off the wall, where we potentially can just smash it. And we did some analysis back in Stockport with our whole squad, and we were 3% slower swimming on top of the water for all the events, good swimmers, than the best in the world as a squad. But we were 13.5% slower turners. And it's like we focus on swimming, but actually where's the gain? And then let's understand turning. So we put some turns practice in, and it lasted about a week because the coach then decided that we weren't swimming enough. And it's like...
And I think that's one of the challenges, isn't it? You've got to keep the faith a bit with some of this.
Well, improving anything comes back to the learning environment we spoke about. And so we're not going to get it right first time. It actually might even take us a year to learn how to do this.
So, when you do a new skill, you go slower. So, for example, in racing, you've got if you have a gearbox and everything like that, and you have a clutch, there's a technique called heel and toe. So you're on the brake, and then you roll your foot off and you blip the throttle as you do a down change, and that kind of helps to stabilize a car and prevents the wheels locking up and stuff like that. But when you first start to do it, you end up going slower than you would have done had you not done it. But over time, it's going to be better for everything, better for the car, better for your pace, better for the tires. Everything's better if you do this.
Yeah, but you've got to learn the skill, and then you've got to be able to practice it when you're under pressure. And it's similar again, unless the purpose and the reason for doing it, and unless you can really truly grasp that, get your head around it, and then go through the hard period of learning the new skill, then usually what will happen is under pressure, you'll go back to what you knew because you knew it and you know that you can do it. And we again, teaching a new technique in swimming, again with turns, another athlete, there's a side turn and then there's a diagonal type turn. And a lot of kids are taught this floppy diagonal turn where ultimately you don't get in a really good streamline hydro in this instance position off the wall where you've got a flat back and arms out. You're a big floppy mess a bit. And so to teach the new turn, and we had one athlete who taught to do this amazing new flat straight over back, awesome streamline position, shoulders in, like it was properly awesome. I mean, the moment in training she could do it, but the moment she hit the first race, she rolled up, she went in, and the first turn was the floppy old turn that she used to do, even though we know she can do the other one. Once she did, she wasn't a part of the process of understanding it, of choosing to change it. And two, she was under pressure. And under pressure, what we do is what we know. And that goes back to the hockey example. You know that under pressure, the goalkeeper was going to go to their right certain or their dominant side that amount of times. It's more likely that you will because you've had so much success with it, or whatever, for whatever reason, it's the way that you do things. Yeah.
And we could chat forever on this stuff. I'd love to have you back on the show sometime if you're up for that. But thank you very much for taking the time and for giving us some insights into your world. And hopefully people listening can, you know, take some of that and think, okay, how can I work that into my own racing, particularly in terms of setting expectations, particularly in terms of managing their preparation and thinking about how they can maybe just do one or two little things a bit better, just to get, and just hopefully unlock a whole load of potential and a lot of performance that they've already got. They just need that. If they put that little structure in place and took that ownership, would be even better. I think the idea of that relationship, thinking about the relationship with your support team, such as it is, fascinating and would be new for a lot of people. So yeah, honestly, just there's so much good stuff in here. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
It's an absolute pleasure. Absolute pleasure. I've really had a lot of fun. If there's two key takeaways, would be that end in mind, work backwards rather than help, not what we tend to do is work forwards. How can I get a little bit better than I am today? Rather than actually, you'll know what you need to do to get better if you actually do the jump forward into the future. You can't predict the future, but you can certainly make some decisions about what you want to achieve, and then you can then work backwards on how you're going to achieve it. So then the decision of today focus is much easier. And the other is, in terms of support, is that whole, we're seeing this shift towards having high technical knowledge but with low directive behavior. So it's creating your own learning environment and not going in there and particularly teaching someone how to suck eggs and telling them how to do it. It is working through that whole open questions in the learning of the skills and the new knowledge to be able to improve it, so that it's not me who still knows it, it's you coming up to and learning that for yourself with guidance and this guided discovery approach to it, rather than a directive, dictatorial type approach, which we're seeing a big shift at in Olympic sport.
Yeah. That would be a big change in motorsport, I would say.
Oh, it's huge in Olympic sport. And often, I know a coach who's switched from coaching one team where he created that to another team where the athlete's expectation was that you'll tell me what to do. And his question to me is, how do I get, I coach like this.
Yeah.
I coach by guiding and by helping them to learn, yet they don't think that's coaching.
Yeah.
Because their expectation of what coaching is different.
And so, I think there's a big thing about confidence here, and it's about credibility. And if you take that route, you can feel your credibility being crushed by the person looking at you going, you don't know what you're talking about. Why are you asking me these questions? You're just fobbing me off or something. And that's the confidence
That's set up in a whole bunch of what we'll call contracting. It's like, and so sitting down with someone to say, look, I'm pretty good at this and this in these areas. I don't know everything. I'm pretty good in these areas. But the way that I'm going to approach this situation with you is you're not going to get away without thinking. And so we'll help you to think. There are moments where, yeah, just if it's annoying or it's not right and it's not working or whatever, then just ask or just say, I'm not going to get offended by that, but I'm not going to tell you the answer straight away, even if I know it, in that coaching sense. And so it's then helping them to learn, and then you can start to do things. You're seeing things in an Olympic sport where it's, if I want someone to learn a skill or something new, we create a game where they're rewarded for that type of behavior, that new behavior, and where the athletes have to work together to be able to problem solve together. Because ultimately, the athlete or the driver is the one out there under pressure who has to make those decisions. They don't have a coach or their technical expert or their instructor or whatever with them at that moment. So the whole thing is recognize that and set that situation up so that you're in that best position to be able to make those decisions under pressure when someone's right on your ass pushing you around that turn. or whatever.
That's really good. So just to sum up on that, planting that seed gives you clarity, and then there's 10x different ways in which you could approach addressing that training requirement, but you have got the goal of performing under pressure in this environment, and you need to know a little bit more about X, Y, and Z, or you need to have felt that. So now you can create practice effectively.
100%. Yeah. I can help you today to get around that corner faster, but will it help you in a race when you're under pressure? Maybe not. But what I want to do is make sure that in a race under pressure you get around that corner and you can make that decision for yourself about what you need to do. And it's not just about today you doing it better.
Yeah.
Today's about you learning how to do it better for when you're under pressure. And it's just that slight shift in the conversation that helps, or in the training process, or in the instructing process, that actually makes a massive difference when it comes to learning and growing and improving and ultimately executing.
Scott, absolutely brilliant. Thank you so much for taking the time. And it's a real pleasure to have you on the show and listen to you speak.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate it massively. And hopefully we can do it again sometime soon.
What a privilege to speak to Scott all the way from Australia. He's got an absolutely fascinating perspective on how we should approach performance in sport, but also in life. I hope you found those insights really useful. It's worth another listen, to be honest. I've already listened to this show 3 times. I'm still picking up new things every time. So until next time, bye for now. If you like this episode, be sure to subscribe to the podcast and visit us at yourdatadriven.com.